Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Bob Seska. You really are sick.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, May 3, 2023, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 833 of the Biden-Harris administration, 552 days until the 24th presidential election. You can find me on Instagram, the Bob Seska. That's my handle. That's where I'm at. Twitter, BobSeska_go. Spoutable, Bob Seska. And, of course, our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. All right, it's Greg Mitchell Day on the podcast. Greg's been here several times before to talk about his one-of-a-kind documentaries about media censorship and little-known chapters in American history. This time we're talking about Greg's latest project called Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. It's about an unprecedented episode of police violence against striking steelworkers in Chicago. 10 workers were murdered by cops, and many more were wounded. And then the newsreel footage got suppressed. The book is out now. Link in the description, and the documentary premieres online on KCET in LA on May 6th, followed by PBS stations across the country after that. It's a remarkable story, and Greg's here to dig right into it. Meantime, think about supporting this fully independent podcast by subscribing to our Patreon page at BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, this is Greg Mitchell talking about the Memorial Day Massacre.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
It's kind of amazing, Greg. You always seem to land on these historic events that never quite made it into the public consciousness. I mean, how do you do this? I mean, do you have a process for landing on these kind of forgotten chapters of history?
Well, I don't really have a process. I think one thing that unites so much of my work or my career, if you will, through you know, more than a dozen books now and now three films, is obsessed with media cover-ups or official cover-ups, I guess. Many of my writing for magazines and going way, way back now, for whatever reason, maybe it was Watergate or however I grew up when I was growing up or whatever. But it seems like without intentionally going out of my way, I seem to gravitate towards, you know, media criticism, but, you know, media cover-ups, official cover-ups, a film, almost everything that I've written about at length in books and now in films, in my own films, relates to some sort of film or movie or footage cover-up. And so I don't know, I guess when I see certain stories like this, it just, it's right in my wheelhouse.
It's incredible that this story, given the level of carnage, hasn't received more attention. And that's what's always crazy to me, Greg. Whenever I hear about your latest project, I mean, why hasn't anyone heard about this before? 10 people were gunned down by police in cold blood. And yet it really doesn't make, certainly not chapters in history books that are accessible by K through 12, maybe in college, certainly. I think in academia, a lot of people get exposed to things like this. But I think generally speaking, it's, you know, sort of lost to history.
Well, it's, that's exactly the reaction I often have to these stories is why haven't I heard about this? And even in some cases, it's in areas that I thought I knew a lot about or I had been exposed to a lot. So when you think you're kind of in touch with certain parts of history or current events, and yet something kind of shocks you, and it almost something that was kind of a media and official cover up at the time becomes almost a historical cover up.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, like you said, where is this in the histories and the popular culture, things like that. So, it's your reaction is much like mine, but it probably sparks you to do certain programs and it sparks me to consider doing a book or now a film.
So let's get into the Memorial Day Massacre, 1937. It was the year before my dad was born, and Republic Steelworkers went on strike in Chicago. What happened that led up to this police massacre?
Well, in a nutshell, there's so much history here with the Depression. And starting around 1935, there was a great explosion in labor actions, which had been kind of dormant for quite a while. And so you had great labor strikes and ferment around the country, most famously at General Motors and Ford. But it really touched all sorts of areas of America, from farm workers to, you know, shop workers and so forth. So it was this incredible surge in union organizing, often quite successful. And 1936, there was the wave of sit down strikes, which also were kind of usually successful. And so we got up into 1937, and the first part of the year. Again, I'm trying to do this in a nutshell, but the giants, the biggest steel company, U.S. Steel, signed a contract with the new steelworkers union. But the smaller, but by no means small, other steel companies refused to even recognize the union. So in late May 1937, the 70,000 workers at these steel plants across the Midwest and Pennsylvania went on strike. And in Chicago, the giant plant was Republic Steel in South Chicago. And they so the workers went on strike. They tried to picket. The police busted a bunch of heads. And so the union called for a community picnic on Memorial Day, where they would, you know, gather support, big community turnout. Women and children came. There was, you know, barbecue and baseball. And it was just like a giant, fun Memorial Day picnic. And so there were so many people came, like maybe up to 1,500, that the organizers said, well, let's march towards the plant and try to set up a picket outside the plant, which was about three blocks away across a great prairie. And, you know, just go and, you know, women and children, and we'll just try to march over there and have a legal, what would have been a legal picket, you know, outside the plant, you know, the 100 yards from the plant or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they were met by a huge contingent of police when they got halfway across this prairie.
Who called in the cops? Were they just came on their own volition? Like they heard about this the strike that was happening and they just showed up? Yeah. Or was it Republic Steel, the people inside, who decided, okay, we got to bring in the cops to break this up?
Yeah, well, a little of both. I mean, the police, of course, you know, against strikers who are, you know, allegedly were radicals and communists and so forth. So they already were, and they already had busted heads a couple nights before.
Yeah.
So they were going to be there no matter what, but they were also in bed with Republic Steel. In fact, they'd set up their headquarters for the day inside the gates of Republic Steel.
Wow.
As we see in the film, you know, in the film has, my film has footage of all this, all the, what was going on inside the plant and the police gathering. And and the march beginning and so forth. And of course, my book I'll gets much more into that. Mm-hmm. But they were, they're very much in bed with Republic. In fact, Republic gave them, besides their usual equipment, gave them axe handles to use that day if they needed to, and gave them tear gas. The police did not have their own tear gas. Republic gave them tear gas. So
what is Republic Steel doing with tear gas? Like, why was that? Was that hand, or they access it somehow?
Yeah, well, they were, as I show in the film and in the book, they were the largest, literally, and I have the documents, which I show. Uh-huh. They were the largest purchasers of tear gas in the entire country in the preceding year. And they basically stocked all their plants for eventualities like this.
Wow.
And of course, they would then give it to the police. So the scenario is, marchers across the prairie, police stop them, and they engage in 5 or 10 minutes of heated discussion, but seemingly, not leading to anything that violent. You know, it's kind of a standoff. It's a Sunday. It's still kind of a picnic crowd. nicely dressed, women and children are around, and now I'll get back to this, but we also have to, one of the focuses of the film and the book is that there was a cameraman from Paramount News on the scene capturing all this in his camera. So we'll get back to that in a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a Paramount News is a major newsreel, and there's a veteran cameraman there capturing the police and the marchers debating and so forth. Okay. So then something happens. And the next thing you know, the police are firing tear gas and firing pistols. And we see in this footage the marchers all turning to flee in panic back across the prairie. And police firing their pistols point blank and then, in the distance at the retreating marchers who are doing nothing but running away.
Oh, wow.
And this is all captured on film. And, in the end, again, jumping ahead a little bit, they would have shot and wounded 40 people, including an 11-year-old boy, and killed 10 mm-hmm. of the, this is a combination of striking workers and union activists and so forth, and would kill 10, including a 17-year-old youth. And then they would, when they'd stop firing, they waded into the retreating crowd and beating them on the head with the axe handles and the clubs, all caught on camera. Just vicious beatings of defenseless people who are, including women,
who are running away.
They're running away because they were caught.
Yeah.
And of course they're tripping and falling and some of them are already wounded and they're getting clubbed in the head. And, again, absolutely no defense for it. They were, they weren't fighting back. They weren't doing anything. So the whole sequence of shooting the guns and then clubbing, totally indefensible. And then the third part of this is that the police then did not call ambulances. They did not have anyone on hand to do first aid. And what they did was they would, rather than try to help people, they lug them, push them, pick them up, and threw them into paddy wagons under arrest, and would be taken, many of them, dead or dying, to distant hospitals, including primarily a prison hospital. So they were arrested for being wounded, I guess, and taken away. So you have this three horrible things all captured: the shooting, the beating, and then the total disinterest in helping the injured.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is documented in the footage, which we'll get to. But not only do I show this in my film, but in the book, my book is the first oral history of this tragedy, And so it includes, in a very lively, you know, sad way, the eyewitness accounts of so many of those, of the activists and those who were wounded, plus, you know, some more famous observers who were there. And so it's all documented almost minute by minute. If you like those kind of books and stories where you get a famous event or something,
yeah,
you kind of can see it unfold in the words of the witnesses. This is the kind of it'll be right up your alley.
Is it Paramount that gathered some of this testimony that you're referring to, or was it just a number of different sources that you gathered all this information from? Yeah,
right. The book is largely made up of, and again, jumping ahead a little bit, testimony that many of these people gave at the sensational Senate hearings.
Okay,
that came. And an 8-part documentary that aired on PBS in 1993, called The Great Depression. I got the transcripts for the interview. So only a tiny, part of one episode was based on this Memorial Day massacre. I got transcripts for all the interviews, including with people like Gore Vidal. And I actually worked on that series. In fact, they had one whole episode about a subject we talked about last year, my previous PBS film on Upton Sinclair's race for governor of California in 1934. And that was the subject of one of the episodes. And so I was very familiar with this program. And so I got permission to use a great deal from these unseen transcripts. In the book, that this eyewitness testimony and commentary is all first person from direct sources that people have, said with little notice in the past.
Was there something that touched off the firing, or did the police just act on their own volition? Was there something that happened, maybe something that they said that the cops said happened that didn't really happen, something along those lines?
Well, what the cops said happened was someone fired, or several people fired from the crowd, which was fired pistols from the crowd, which was completely false. Mm-hmm. Now, what appears to be partly true is that while all this arguing was going on and the police were pushing and threatening to do all sorts of things, some people from the back of the crowd threw a few stones. Someone apparently threw a tree branch that, sailed over the police heads or something. There was some pushing going on. But there was nothing that particularly triggered any, an attack on the police, or people were trying to march through the crowd, or people were throwing bricks or anything like this. But what happened, so I think what happened was the police panicked. The police were trigger happy. Mm. They gave like a 5-minute warning, you must disperse. And when the crowd did not disperse, they said, okay, we'll get you to disperse. And, it probably one cop or two cops fired and then the rest joined in. It's impossible to say, but there definitely was very little provocation considering what happened afterwards.
Yeah, it seems to me it kind of tickles my conspiracy theory cortex. I hear about this and I wonder, I think about the DNC in 68 and how there were instigators who were touching off some of the police violence, and maybe not the protesters themselves, but infiltrators. Pat Buchanan famously talked about things like that. And so with this story,
I was in that crowd, by the way, in 68, but
I
was not an instigator. I was not an instigator.
Right. But I remember reading about Pat Buchanan sitting in one of the hotel room windows and just making phone calls and getting people to go in and inflame the cops, to deliberately antagonize the cops so that they would start to get violent. And then everything would fly wildly out of hand, as I'm sure you witnessed.
Well, there were some captured in this footage.
Yeah.
Were obvious. Plain, well, I'll say plainclothes people from Republic Steel with axe handles.
Wow.
Who are also wading into the crowd and hitting people over the head. Whether they were you know, pushing the cops to do this, can't really say, but they were there, definitely there in the police crowd. And of course there always was some level of instigators, infiltrators in any protest, as you know, who may be pushing protesters to do violent things. So I don't know, but you know, that the bottom line is that the next day virtually every newspaper, both local and as far away as the New York Times, endorsed the police explanation, which of course we've seen thousands of times since.
Yeah.
But the headlines were all, 10 killed in riot, mob attacks police, dozens injured, it's all totally buying the police, even down to the demonstrators probably were the first to fire shots. There was the line that these people who were shot in the back were actually shot by the protesters who were firing at the police. And so forth. So the immediate reaction in the media and the press was to buy the police explanation. And, this was going to really go away. But then there was an aftermath that we can get to.
So Paramount has this footage. And is this the next step where we're talking about this raw footage and the decision to include it in a newsreel? I think that was the first thought, like, OK, we're going to start running with this. And then.
Yep.
So walk me through that process, the process at Paramount, where they have to decide whether to make this public.
Right. Well, they had an ace cameraman on the scene, Orlando Lippert, who I think had just come from the Indianapolis 500 or something, on the scene. And the footage, which you'll see at length in the film, is incredibly dramatic. I mean, it would have been among the most historic and significant and dramatic ever captured. I mean, you see the police firing, you see the crowd trying to get out of the way, more firing, and then the whole wave of beatings, and then the callousness afterwards, where people are being dragged to paddy wagons and thrown in, and women with blood flowing down their faces and so forth. So it's incredible footage. That's the first thing you have to say. It's like the footage is like nothing anyone's ever seen, even to this day, really.
Is it really the first of its kind, wasn't it? Because some earlier breakups of protests, I think there were protesting, maybe it was World War One veterans who didn't get their pension and were broken.
The bonus march.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know that any of that was filmed, but was this the first of its kind where we actually see this going on?
Well, newsreels for a few years, and of course, this is sort of a new phenomenon, and I suppose we should. If we have time, we should back up and say how important newsreels were at the time, because the movies were incredibly popular and everyone was going to movies. There was no TV, and newsreels were shown before every movie, and they were incredibly popular and influential. So that needs to be said. But they were fairly new. But there had been footage to this point of violence at the Ford, the great Ford protest at Ford and General Motors, and scattered places where there were scenes, and some of them are in my film, of police firing tear gas, police whacking some workers. There certainly had been some violence before. I think four were killed at Ford a few years earlier, and I think two were killed in Youngstown. It's not that this was, the scale of this Memorial Day massacre was, the worst ever to this day. But there had been other violence, and some of it had been captured, but not at such close hand and such beginning to end, and nothing like the footage that was captured by Paramount. And in fact, Paramount created in the days after a 4-minute, you'd really more like a movie short. It was an entire newsreel, you might have, devoted to this. And the narrator took a very, you might say, pro-police line, but the footage, you know, had to show the police, you know, attacking and firing and clubbing and the aftermath. So the footage itself said one thing, and the narrator was trying to say something else. But they, you know, created it, but they then self-suppressed it. They did not release it. They kept it in the can, and it was not, no one was going to hear about it further. But then kind of word seeped out that this footage existed, and the Senate subcommittee headed by Robert La Follette, as you may know that name, as a great progressive from Wisconsin, decided to consider having a hearing. And so they subpoenaed the footage. They received the footage, and one of the staffers leaked it to one of the leading investigative reporters of the time, a guy named Paul Anderson, who then wrote a couple major pieces for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which were then reprinted in the New York Times and a few other places, talking for the first time about what was actually on this footage. And of course, it was like a bombshell, because it was, this isn't what we heard. He talked to some of the victims, and, you know, interviewed some of the people, and should have won the Pulitzer, really. So suddenly the word was out on what was on this footage. And so Paramount then created a second film and again refused to release it. And when they were queried why they are burying this footage, a spokesman said, you know, we're afraid this will set off riots in the theaters, and, you know, there'll be more people that get hurt.
So why did they go ahead with a second one real quick?
Well, I think they felt the second one was a little, and I've seen all of them.
Yeah.
One of the first people to see all three versions, and all three are used in the film and talked about it in the book. I think the second one's a little more even-handed, and I think they sort of felt, well, maybe if we do it a little more even-handed, we can, you know, put it out there. But again, they failed to put it out there. Now,
right, which doesn't make any sense. Make a second reel and then not put it out anyway, just like the first one. It's like a waste of time. But
But now you might say Paramount was actually deciding on their own. This will be very dangerous if we put out there.
Yeah.
In reality, and especially, and again, it's not really even a conspiracy. You have to diffuse your head, you might say. They probably were under pressure from Chicago officials and police officials and all sorts of people, maybe even Washington officials, to not put this out because it was so negative about the police and could inflame, not necessarily cause riots in the theaters, which was the excuse, but it certainly could inflame pro-union people around the country. So the second one is also buried. So La Follette goes ahead with his hearings, which is the end of June and beginning of July. So it's a month or so after the massacre. And being a good progressive, he slants it. He definitely brings out the argument against the police. He makes all the top police people testify, and it's frankly kind of embarrassing, some of the things they say about the, for example, workers getting shot in the back by their own people. Someone saying he thought this was the workers were high in marijuana. You could look in their eyes and say they were high in marijuana. Mexicans. The Mexicans in the crowd are the ones who are to blame. Just really embarrassing things, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, again, to make a long story short, near the end of the hearings, which went very badly for the police, they screened the Paramount footage for the first time, and even did it in slow motion, which was very rare at that time. And of course, the press is widely covering this. This is now a sensational story. And they see the footage for the first time. And so now the coverage really turns, not completely, because you still have the Chicago Tribune and all sorts of, you know, conservative papers, like it'd be like Fox News today. Mm-hmm. They just accept this, you know, the camera is lying, you know, before they wanted to embrace what the camera was showing. And now the camera is lying.
Yeah, it's just like Tucker Carlson taking the insurrection footage and finding the moments when nothing was happening.
Yeah, exactly. They would have done some of this media had, if it was like TV then, that's exactly what they would have done. They would have taken the same footage and showed how it was all the protesters' fault. But in any case, so now Paramount, I guess, really felt they had to release the footage more than a month later. So they do a third newsreel, and they finally put that out. They finally distribute that. And, they claim this is unedited and this is the whole story. But, of course, they dropped the first 15 seconds, which show the police firing at the demonstrators while claiming they're showing the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, the footage is finally out there, although edited. So what happens? Yeah, it's shown in New York, and the crowd, crowd hisses and boos and things like that. It's shown around the country in different places. But even after all this, it is banned in Chicago. It's banned in St. Louis. It's banned even in Massachusetts from being screened. And it's also being banned by entire theater chains who won't let it be distributed to their theaters. So It does emerge, it is seen by many,
mm-hmm.
but even after all this, it is still, banned in many parts of the country. So 3 weeks later, the La Follette Committee issues its report, which in my book, I reprint many pages of.
Mm-hmm.
In the appendix, there's an appendix in the book after all the oral histories. Where I reprint a large part of the La Follette report, and it really lays it out step by step and perfectly persuasive and very bad for the police. Nevertheless, there is a coroner's jury in Chicago, which concludes that this was justifiable homicide. All 10 deaths were, quote unquote, justifiable homicide.
How did they reach that conclusion? Like, what kind of bullshit led them down that road?
There was a conflict, and police in self-defense, or police thought they were protecting the plant, and they fired. But they had to admit that everyone was killed by police bullet, and they took the testimony that the vast majority were shot in the back or in the side. So there was really no doubt that the basic story that it was all from the police and that people were shot in the back as they fled was basically true. Nevertheless, they came to that conclusion. So no police, not a single police was punished, but you had dozens of the demonstrators who had been arrested and were fined, were in jail for anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And were, had to eventually pleaded guilty and were fined, some. So that was the immediate kind of thing. And then workers, the strike had been sort of broken because of all this. And so workers started returning to work. So it certainly seemed like a short-term loss, but there were some long-term gains that we can get to if you want.
Okay, today's show is brought to you by the After Party Podcast on our Patreon page. There's another show that we do at the end of the week. You got the Tuesday show, you got the Wednesday show, which is this one, and the Thursday show. But there's a fourth show that we record every week, me and Kimberly Johnson. who I'm having sex with, by the way. We record a fourth Bob Seska Show podcast for the week. It's called The After Party. Friday After Party podcast is loaded with all the politics you want, while also including uncensored, completely obscene conversations about sex, drugs, movies, television, our personal lives, all the crap we can't get away with on the free show. So please help support this podcast by subscribing to our Friday After Party for just $10 per month. And bonus, you're also going to get two Shadow Docket shows every week included in that level of support. Plus, you got access to the comments under each episode. You got the community tab where you can post your own blog entries. Plus, you get access to the app and a whole lot more. That's BobSeskaShow.com, or just click the all caps Patreon link beneath the logo at BobSeska.com. And we thank you.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Was there ever any justice for the families of the murdered workers? Was there justice for some of the wounded workers who were able to get out of it without being outwardly killed? So what happened to them after all of this becomes public?
Eventually, later, many months or a couple years later, some of them won legal actions or won some sort of payout, or the company went, they had a pool of money. Some of them got, $10,000 or $1,000 or something like that. There was some small payouts that were made, but certainly nothing like you'd see today. Company didn't admit they did anything wrong. It's just, okay, let's make this go away. Which they did. And as you said, pretty much in history books, it's gone away. Which is, kind of startling.
Given the fact that the footage eventually went public, you would think that it would have echoed since then throughout all of this time. We're talking about 8.5 decades since that happened.
Yeah.
So I wonder why that hasn't been a point of discussion at all, because we hear about so many other similar cases. Obviously, there's Bloody Sunday, Montgomery, Alabama, of course, 68 in Chicago, as we were just talking about, Kent State. We almost had another example of it in Lafayette Park for Trump's Bible photo op. That could have happened right then and there. So it seems like that kind of event, the Memorial Day massacre, would have had a louder resonance in the time since it happened.
Well, that was one of the, I guess you'd say, long-term benefits of it, is that it was so stark and murderous it gave both labor militants and police officials pause that showing how it can get out of hand. And of course it wasn't a great day for the police, in terms of their reputation and everything else. So it's something both sides did not want to repeat. And as I say in the book and the film, this was the last true major violent conflict on this scale in history in the US. With anything approaching this death toll, you've had scattered strikes and, things have gotten in and miners, coal miners or whatever, but there are scattered where one or two people get shot or one or two people may die. And, a few, get wounded or something like that, but nothing approaching this, 10 dead, 30s others shot, and, you know, and 50 others, you know, injured in beatings in 5 minutes, really. So nothing has approached that. So it, right. Even as that, if you just have a signpost and just say, okay, what was the last, you know, what turned the tide in terms of super violent labor police conflict? Mm-hmm. You know, there was this. So that's one a positive thing that came out of it. I mean, another thing was that there was the labor did get more sympathy from the general public. These steel workers, it took 2 years, but they eventually got recognized by the by these steel companies. They got the contracts, you know, more fair contracts. And labor in general, as you know, did very well in the 40s and 50s and 60s. You know, this was a great period of union dominance. And so there was some, you know, public opinion helped turn in favor of workers. They weren't right. all radicals and communists. And so there was that. But, you know, there's kind of a third kind of what I think is kind of an interesting something I dug out that's, you know, in the book and the film, which I think is kind of amazing in a way, that in the aftermath of this and the controversy over the film footage, various commentators in Chicago and outside Chicago started calling for police vans to be, and emergency vans and so forth, to be outfitted with cameras, which had never come up as something. They said, well, we need police to have cameras to either prove their side of the story or kind of show what really happened.
It sounds so familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. So years later, we get body cams and dashboard cams. And now every day, almost, you read about some sort of police beating or police shooting. And there's, let's see what's on the body cam or the dashboard cam and so forth. So you could say that this incident also led to but it was the precursor of raising the issue of, you know, using film video footage to document violent confrontations between police and, you know, average citizens.
That's what I love about these stories you tell, Greg. This one, for example, you have the tip of the iceberg, which is the suppression of information vital to the public interest. But there's so much more going on, mega corporations and the anti-union sentiment, police violence and overreach, gun culture, solving problems with firearms. And then, of course, the primary focus, the primary peg on this, which is the suppression of information, as I said. And it's just an incredible multi-layered story that applies so well to many of the things we're observing now. Is that I assume that was part of your consideration as far as covering all of this, right?
Well, you know, it's also the current and sometimes exciting surge in union organizing.
Yeah.
Of course, we've seen it just this week with the writers. You don't think of the Hollywood and TV writers as, you know, the huddled masses, you know, pretty white collar.
Oh, yeah.
But you have this dramatic walkout. And of course, we've seen, you know, teacher strikes and all that. But also, I guess what really got me going was at least the encouraging organizing in new areas such as Amazon and Starbucks. And in the back of the book, in the appendix, we also chronicle some of these more current, in new fields. You have this organizing in all these new fields today, besides the more traditional ones. So it's definitely a time of people are reconsidering the value of unions, and the opinion of polls show that, you know, unions are getting more and more public opinion support now.
Yeah.
So there may be a turning point. We're never going to go back to, you know, 60% of the workforce unionized, but Certainly, there's been a reversal of late, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, Proposition 22 in California, Michigan repealed its right to work status. This is all incredible news, signifying this resurgence in the labor movement. And you're kind of riding that wave with this particular story, in a sense. Obviously, it had a tragic ending, a sort of a cautionary tale. But it does fit right in with, as you said, this gigantic, I don't know if it's gigantic, but certainly a union resurgence that's underway right now.
Yeah.
So it applies very well.
Amazing, what's amazing about this incident is that, nevertheless, until now, what has gotten written about the most with, you know, labor and stuff? It's all stuff that's goes back much further. You know, the Haymarket scandal, the Ludlow massacre, you know, Joe Hill, you know, I mean, it's like, so people are kind of shocked that this happened in 1937, which is kind of starting more towards the modern age. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah. 1937 is more, you know, feels more like today. I mean, you've got talk about film footage and, you know, media coverage and congressional probes and all that kind of stuff, which is kind of more the modern age. If you go back 150 years, it's really a different world, you know. But yet this story has been covered so little. So I'm happy to be able to present it in the film and the book.
To see civilian bodies lying in the grass surrounded by these cops, it's something that obviously, as we mentioned, we've seen hints of, certainly the beatings in the South that took place against black activists, civil rights activists, Kent State, as we were saying, too. And that is immensely disturbing. It's just four college kids, right? But this is something that, as you pointed out, we've never, ever seen at this scale. It seems like these days, with the divisiveness in our politics and so on, seems like something like this is kind of a hair trigger away. It seems like we could stumble into a situation very much like this. And I imagine if it does happen, it would be potentially way more than just 10 people.
Yeah. It could have happened on January 6th if police had fired, but of course that's a completely bad analogy, in the sense that the insurrectionists were coming, you know, were actually trying to invade the Capitol and breaking through police lines and beating police. So if police had fired on January 6th, there would have been more cause for firing their weapons. But the Memorial Day massacre, there was nothing even approaching that.
And it's
disturbing. I mean, to get to see the footage today, I am interested what people who watch my film, what they will make. Now they've heard all about it here. Okay, now you're actually going to see the footage, some of it in slow motion. And I am curious what people will think, but I'm pretty confident they're going to be shocked. There's even a scene which I think I've nailed down for the first time, thanks to these transcripts, was you will see in the footage an injured worker being taken to a car with a Red Cross sign on it. This is a workers. The workers had, the police did not have any ambulances out there, but the workers had a couple large vehicles to take away anyone wounded. Mm-hmm. And so they take this guy, obviously gravely wounded, to the car. And that's what you see in the footage. But from the testimony later, we learn that off camera, police went to this car and dragged this guy out of the car and dragged him to a paddy wagon. And on the way, the tourniquet that the workers had tied around his leg was slipped off, and so he bled to death.
Oh, God.
And that is not actually shown in the footage. You see the first part of the footage where it seems like the workers are rescuing this guy. So that's the kind of thing where, with the benefit of research and being able to write, you know, at some length about this, you kind of get to see the full picture, and it's even worse than what the footage captures. So I think the combination of watching the footage and kind of hearing from the eyewitnesses and and learning about the aftermath really puts it all together for the first time.
Yeah, I was thinking about this too, Greg, is I was wondering if this happened today, how it would get covered through the lens of our political press. And my initial thought was the obvious one. Okay, you know, the Red Hat Entertainment Complex, whatever you want to call it, they're going to be pro-cop, and then the rest of us normals are going to be pro-striker. But then I started to think about it. I said, you know, given the awfulness of this footage, and especially the scene that you just described with the tourniquet coming off and the protester dying as a result of blood loss and so forth, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that it would be that cut and dry. It seems like the brutality of it would supersede our divisive politics. What do you think about that?
Oh, boy. It's really hard to say. I do think that you would get the... assuming this kind of thing happened in a, let's say a political setting, but a setting where you'd sort of say, well, on one side, you've got the law enforcement, and on the other, you've got people who are being called left-wing or Antifa or whatever you want to say, people who are on the side of, let's say, the liberal or left side. On some sort of protest, could be an anti-war protest, you know. If it could be politicized, I mean, if it's a bunch of, you know, people out, just a crowd that's gathering for some reason, and they get brutally attacked, and it really seems like, boy, this is just absolutely horrendous. If there's any kind of political aspect to it, I think it would be politicized.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of, again, it's sort of disheartening when you go back to this. If you look at the press coverage from the time then, again, down to the Washington Post and the New York Times and so on and so forth, everyone not only buying the police argument, but basically what they're saying is, okay, we know these labor people are militants. They're often radicals. Some of them are communist influenced, even though, you know, so many hundreds of thousands had won contracts, you know, from Henry Ford, you know, so how communist could they be, you know? okay, these people on that side are, you know, radicals, and, so they don't deserve the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the question when you come down, who gets the benefit of the doubt? And it's, you know, it's always been true that in the media, you know, whether it's police officials, the Pentagon, the White House, always has gotten the benefit of the doubt. And so it's hard to believe that that would be, you know, that would be different today.
It's, I got to tell you, Greg, this is an incredible story. I'm so glad that that you in particular landed on this, because this seems like it's like a match made in whatever, match made in hell. You know,
well,
Greg Mitchell covering
this
kind of story. Yeah.
Yeah. And I hope you particularly enjoy. One of my great heroes, fortunately, I was interviewed by and met him, and was Studs Terkel, one of the great radio hosts of all time.
Oh, yeah.
He is a Chicago legend. And he was not at the day of the massacre, but he was there the next day at the site where there was the headquarters or first aid station had been set up. And he was a young man. He was an actor at the time in Chicago before he became, you know, best-selling author and radio host. And, so in my book, The Oral History, he has a rather prominent role. He was even there, like I said, he was at the site the next day, and he has this incredible description of seeing all these bandaged, hobbling workers and comparing them to photos of the Matthew Brady from the Civil War, of post-Gettysburg, you know, soldiers. It's just an incredible image. And then there was a great protest rally at the Civic Center in Chicago a week later that Studs attended, and he talks about what he saw there. So I mean, he becomes a prominent figure in the book, and he's like I said, for a radio man like yourself, or I guess I should call you a radio podcast man.
I'll take it.
Studs is like one of the heroes of the century, or should be.
Yeah.
So I'll be curious what your reaction will be.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the whole thing. I've only seen the trailer at this point, and I will definitely check this out. The book and the documentary are called Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. The book is out right now. I got a link in the description of bobsuska.com. Just click this episode dated 5/3/23, scroll on down, and there it is. And of course, the documentary premieres on PBS KCET in Los Angeles on May 6th. It's a few days from now, as well as online at pbs.org. You can check your local listings after that. Greg and his producer, Lynn Goldfarb, make the best documentaries. These are just incredible pieces of work. History that you've never heard of before. Must-watch events. Thank you so much, my friend, for getting the word out about these lesser-known chapters in our history. It is absolutely crucial to get a better understanding of where we come from and that not everything is exceptionalism, is it?
Yeah. Well, Bob, thank you for that. But I just want to make one point is that this... everyone everywhere in the country can view this film,
yeah,
as you mentioned, via pbs.org, starting Saturday night to Sunday, PBS apps, or even if you want to go to the KCET site, that's the major station in LA, the KCET site will be streaming it, and it'll be up for many weeks. So starting Saturday night or Sunday, everyone can view the entire film free of charge, so I'm happy to be able to provide that.
Well, congratulations on another outstanding couple of pieces of work between the book and the documentary itself, and I can't wait. I'm already starting to think about the next project, Greg, so you got to let me know when it happens, when it drops.
All right. Thank you, Bob. I always appreciate being here.
Thanks, my friend. Good talk.
By the looks of you, I'm the only one who knew. have the looks of you. I'm the only